From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, in the fight over charters versus district schools, is there another way that combines the best of both worlds?
The challenge for all of us in education is the same, to make sure that schools are successful in saving kids' lives.
Also, new analysis of the inextricable ties that bind slavery and colonization in early New England. Plus,
my conscience won't let me go shoot my brother or some poor hungry people in the mud for big powerful America and shoot them for what?
In 1971, Muhammad Ali fought the draft all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. We'll talk to the Boston lawyer who represented him.
It was extremely controversial, and it was that much more important for somebody who had as much at stake as he did to take a stand.
That's next on Radio Boston. First, the news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. In 1971, Jonathan Shapiro was a young lawyer with the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. He'd already been working for several years on civil rights cases when he was asked to take on a new client, a man who happened to be the heavyweight champion of the world.
And all of you white boys are breaking your neck to get to Switzerland and Canada and London. I'm not going to help nobody get something my Negroes don't have. If I'm going to die, I'll die now right here fighting you. If I'm gonna die, you my enemy. My enemy is the white people, not Viet Cong or Chinese or Japanese. You my opposer when I want freedom. You my opposer when I want justice. You my opposer when I want equality. You won't even stand up for me in America for my religious beliefs, and you want me to go somewhere and fight, but you won't even stand up for me here at home.
Well, in April 1967, Muhammad Ali refused to be drafted into the U.S. Army and to fight in the Vietnam War. Ali claimed conscientious objector status on the basis of his religion. As a consequence, he was stripped of his heavyweight title, banned from boxing, convicted of draft evasion, and faced a prison sentence. Ali appealed his conviction. The case reached the Supreme Court in 1971, and that's when Ali's lawyer, Chauncey Eskridge, turned to Jonathan Shapiro at the NAACP Legal Defense Fund for help. Well, today, Jonathan Shapiro is a partner at the Boston law firm Shapiro, Weisberg & Guerin. He came into our studios a little earlier this afternoon to talk about what it was like to fight on behalf of Muhammad Ali. And note, this conversation features one piece of historical tape that contains a racial epithet. Jonathan Shapiro began by telling us why he joined Ali's legal team and the major issues that were at stake.
Ali had been drafted by a draft board from which blacks had been systematically excluded. There just were no blacks on any draft boards in the Deep South, including Kentucky. And we thought that that was just like the juries from which blacks had been excluded, where we raise these issues every day, and we thought it was equally applicable to draft boards. Uh-huh. Another one of the issues was the persecution of the black Muslims.
Well, then there was also, in addition to that, the issue of the person fighting this battle was one of the most famous people in the world. And I want to play a little bit more tape of Muhammad Ali from the time between 1967 and 1971, and how eloquent and vocal he was about why he believed he did not want to go and fight on behalf of the United States in Vietnam.
My conscience won't let me go shoot my brother or some darker people or some poor hungry people in the mud for big powerful America and shoot them for what? They never called me nigger. They never lynched me. They never put no dogs on me. They never robbed me of my nationality, raped and killed my mother and father. Well, I'm going to shoot them for what? How am I going to shoot them? Them little poor little black people, little babies and children and women. How can I shoot them poor people? Just take me to jail.
And of course, Muhammad Ali was facing the potential of having to serve 5 years in jail. Can you take us back to that time briefly and just remind us, like, what was the political climate in the United States? Because here we had the clash of civil rights what was at one time a popular, then very unpopular war in Vietnam. And, you know, this world-renowned sports figure. I mean, what were the tensions? What was the feeling like in the late 60s, early 70s?
Well, of course, the civil rights movement was at its height. This was at about the same time that Martin Luther King began to oppose the war in Vietnam, and that made that whole issue so very controversial, and to a certain extent, it created fissures in the movement.
Now, I want to get to the legal argument that was made before the court in 1971. But before that, did you have a chance to meet Muhammad Ali when you were preparing the case?
I did. He came to the office in New York, and as you can imagine, everybody in the office found an excuse to be in the reception area at the time he came, because everybody wanted to meet him, to see him, to shake his hand. And he was an imposing figure. He was 6'3", and his hands were very large, as was his person.
Yeah. And so was it ever discussed what might happen if he lost before the Supreme Court? Because, as we mentioned, he could have gone to jail. I mean, did he tell you about how he felt about that?
Well, I think obviously he knew that, and he was ready to do that. And he was putting his life, his freedom, and his career on the line because of what he believed in. And that made it so important.
Yeah. So it was another lawyer, Chauncey Eskridge, who actually did the oral argument before the Supreme Court in 1971. But if I understand correctly, you wrote most of the briefs and did most of the legal preparation for the day.
I think I wrote everything that was written. And, of course, although you can't see or hear me on the clip, I was sitting by Chauncey's side when the case was argued. Interestingly enough, my law school dean was Irwin Griswold, arguing for the government.
No kidding. Wow. Oh, so tell us what it was like on the day of oral argument.
Well, of course, this was the first time I had ever been to the Supreme Court, and it's an imposing, very exciting. I was 30 years old at the time, maybe 31, and a young lawyer, and this was extremely exciting to be there, to be part of it.
Yeah. So summarize for us, if you could, what the basis of what ended up being the winning argument was. Why did you tell the United States that Cassius Clay, Muhammad Ali, should be allowed conscientious objector status?
In order to obtain conscientious objector status, you had to be opposed to war for religious reasons. You had to be opposed to all wars rather than any particular war, and you had to be sincere. The Justice Department recommended to the board that they deny the exemption for three reasons. They said that, number one, Ali's objection to the war was political and racial and not religious. They also said that his objection was selective. He only opposed the war in Vietnam, not all wars. And finally, they said he was not sincere.
Right.
We said that all three of those reasons were wrong.
Well, we actually have tape of the oral argument made before the Supreme Court in 1971 in this case. And first, let's listen to a moment from U.S. Solicitor General Irwin Griswold. And here he is making the argument on behalf of the government, along the lines of what you just said, that while he acknowledged that Ali's objection was religious, he said it was also political, which therefore he believed vacated the conscientious objector status that Ali was seeking. So let's listen.
There is in this record a basis in fact for the conclusion that the petitioner's objection, though religious, is selective. Now, that is, that he is not opposed to participation in war in any form as the statute requires. but that he is in fact opposed to fighting what he regards as the white man's wars, although having no religious or conscientious scruples against participation in war which would defend the black man's interests.
I'm wondering, hearing that now, in 2016, what does it make you think?
That it's still wrong.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because there's also a moment when Chauncey Eskridge, arguing on behalf of Muhammad Ali, basically says to the justices, like, there were a lot of hypotheticals put out there. You know, it seems as if at some point in time, the government was just looking for a scenario by which Muhammad Ali would say, yes, this is the kind of war that I agree to. But such a scenario didn't exist. And then Eskridge went on and said this.
They say that the record infers the inference that petitioner would fight tomorrow, quote unquote, in a defensive war on behalf of Muslims. This reminds us of the case of Sicarella, where the hypothetical questions was put to Jehovah's Witness. What would they do if they did so and so, or if so and so and so. Now, they have taken some language juxtaposed against other language, and they come to this conclusion. But nowhere in the record has the registrar ever said that he would fight with weapons against anybody.
It's so interesting going back and reading the transcript and listening to the argument, because a lot of what the justices questioned seemed to center on this idea of whether the objection was religious or political and how they could define where that boundary was for members of the Nation of Islam.
Yeah, and to a certain extent, that involved looking at the publications of the Nation of Islam. And that was really one of the things that I think had an impact on the Supreme Court. Because when the Supreme Court voted at the end of the week in which the case was argued, the vote was 5-3 to affirm the conviction. The case was assigned to Justice Harlan to write an opinion. His clerk brought to his attention a number of the works that had been cited in the briefs, the ones that had been written by Elijah Muhammad. And he, the clerk, became convinced that the principles of the Nation of Islam opposed war in any form, and he persuaded Justice Harlan that that was the case. Justice Harlan changed his vote, and when he did so, it became 4-4. An equally divided court affirms a conviction. So the court was faced with the notion of affirming Ali's, the most famous athlete in the world, conviction, sending him to jail by a court that couldn't make up its mind. And the other justices found that unacceptable and eventually changed their vote to agree with Harlan, who was a very respected justice on the court. When the other justices changed, that left only Warren Berger as the only dissenter. And I think in the end, he decided he couldn't be the only dissenter. And the decision was unanimous.
So it went from 5-3 in against Ali to 8-0 in his favor.
Exactly.
What did it mean to you when you found out that, that Ali had won unanimously?
I was quite stunned. It was, as you can see from the record, one of the last decisions of the term, that particular term. And so we were waiting and waiting, and when it finally came, we were astonished.
Now, you, as we discussed, you were with the NAACP's Legal Defense Fund. How much of an impact did this case have on your life and your career in the months and years afterwards?
I certainly think that the experience validated much of what I had done before and continues to validate what I've done since, because I've always continued to handle a lot of civil rights cases and criminal cases. And as I say, I think this experience and the realization that the work we did and continue to do does have an impact, not only on the life of an individual, but in this case, the life of the country.
Well, Jonathan Shapiro is a partner at Shapiro, Weisberg, and Guerin. In 1971, he was a member of the NAACP's Legal Defense Fund. And amongst his more famous victories is in the case of Clay versus the United States. That's the case we've been talking about where Muhammad Ali asserted his right to be a conscientious objector before the United States Supreme Court and won. Mr. Shapiro, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, before we take a break, we want to play just one more clip of Muhammad Ali himself. Now, the champ had been banned from boxing, as we mentioned, so while his case was being decided, Ali frequently spoke at campus anti-war rallies, and he used those speeches as an opportunity to answer a question he was so often asked. Why fight the draft when he, the greatest of all time, had so much to lose?
I would like to say that I did not lose a thing. Up until this very moment, I haven't lost one thing. I have gained a lot. Number one, I have gained a peace of mind. I have gained a peace of heart. I now know that I'm in content with Almighty God Himself, whose proper name is Allah. I have also gained the respect of everyone here today. As you read the newspapers and the press now, you see that I am now in court. I am in court seeking justice under the laws of the land. In this country, the United States of America, ministers are exempt from the armed services. And if they choose, I am a Muslim minister and a teacher of the religion of Islam. It has been said that I have two alternatives, either go to jail or go to the army. But I would like to say that there is another alternative, and that alternative is justice.
Muhammad Ali. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We'll be back. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The debate over education reform frequently comes down to charters versus district schools. Call it a bright line or an overly simplistic divide or a political dichotomy. However you describe it, the divide is there. But some education advocates say there's a third way in education, that it doesn't have to be either or, but and, incorporating the best ideas and practices from charter schools and district schools in an attempt to make all schools better. Well, one of those advocates is Chris Gabrielli. He's the CEO of the education consulting group Empower Schools, chairman of the Massachusetts Board of Higher Education, and a lecturer at Harvard's Graduate School of Education. And full disclosure, Gabrielli is also a financial supporter of WBUR's education reporting. But he joins us now in the studio. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Glad to be with you.
It's great to have you. We're going to talk about the third way, quote unquote, in just a moment. But I also want to introduce the person sitting right next to you, Lisa Geisbahn. She's the executive director of the advocacy group Citizens for Public Schools, which has been supporting public schools since 1982 here in Massachusetts. Lisa Geisbahn, welcome to you.
Thank you.
It's great to have you. So, listeners, we also want to hear from you because I know you have a lot of informed and passionate thoughts about education. Do you think there can be a new way, a third way, somewhere between district and charter schools that we can incorporate into education in Massachusetts? Can we take best practices from both models and put them together? And if so, what would that third way look like? Or do you think this is just opening the door to more charter schools? I know there are some of you out there who might think that too. Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also send us a tweet, as always, at Radio Boston. So, Chris, let me just first start with you. When we say there's an idea of this third way, I mean, you actually hosted U.S. Education Secretary John King last week in Boston to talk about the concept. So, I mean, what does a third way mean?
Yeah, that's a fair question. And, you know, I think in theory and in practice, let me say in theory, it is, I think you captured it well. So, you know, there are some things about districts that people really want to keep. They want to keep universal service, that every student be served. They want to keep that there's a democratic voice in decision making, that elected and appointed officials are at the table in public discussions about those decisions. I think they want to keep the deal for teachers, is the working conditions and deal for teachers is fair and sustainable. On the other hand, there's some good things that charters have put forward. They brought a level of autonomy and accountability at the school level that we have not historically had, and in some cases have been able to turn that into really great results for kids. And they've brought a certain energy around kind of a relentless spirit of improvement, again, at their best, that has really made a difference. And so, you know, that's sort of the theory. Can't you have from both Category A and Category B? Out in Springfield, Massachusetts, there's a Springfield Empowerment Zone Partnership. It was formed by the school committee out there, by the union out there, by the mayor and superintendent, by the state, and by us. Mm-hmm. And it houses 9 very poorly performing, struggling middle schools where students have been doing poorly for years, and where it was clear something new and different had to happen. And what's cool is the teachers agreed by a 92% to 8% to a contract that's so different that all the working conditions are set at the schools. The district provides most of the money in the buildings so that teachers and educators in the buildings are able to make the decisions that matter about the school schedule, about hiring, about curriculum, about how the budget's spent. You know, we're really excited to see the early results.
So Springfield, in another example, which I know third way advocates bring up, is Lawrence. But in both of those cases, I mean, the schools essentially sort of hit rock bottom. Is that what's necessary for the door to be open for a third way? I mean, is this something that would only really work for the most poorly performing of poorly performing districts?
Well, I think that's a place where we know we need to make probably the biggest changes, because what we've been doing hasn't been working. But we also presented about Denver, Colorado, a place we also work, where, for example, a group of middle to high performing district schools that had some degrees of autonomies, and there's, I think, schools like this in Boston as well, wanted the same deal that charters get, the high level of autonomy. And Denver's recently announced a decision to go forward with that. So I think it can happen in different environments. I think ultimately educators need to be trusted and challenged to do the things it takes to help kids succeed.
Okay, so there's a lot more to dig into there, but Lisa, let me bring you in here. I mean, what's your first reaction, your first thought about the possibility of finding a new way, a third way?
Well, some of it sounds positive and interesting, giving teachers more autonomy. That's a good thing. But, you know, it's pretty new and unproven at this point. And it's not something that's going to be on the ballot for voters to look at. And there is something that's going to be on the ballot in November.
Regarding charter schools.
Regarding charter schools, yeah. And raising the cap. And it just seems funny to be talking about this now when we have this very sort of momentous decision coming up that is going to have a huge impact and draw hundreds of millions of dollars away from struggling district schools.
Okay, can I jump in here? Because I take your point about that. But isn't that also, you know, exactly why a conversation about a third way that's not, you know, again, it's not the... Should it be more charters or fewer charters? Isn't that why it makes this conversation that advocates are trying to push more compelling?
Well, I think, again, it kind of moves us away from the big picture, which is that we're sort of under-resourcing our schools. There's been a big conversation about the foundation budget that was first established by the 1993 Education Reform Act, and it's been concluded that you know, it's not adequate anymore because of rising costs like special education and healthcare costs. So we really just, the pot is not big enough to serve the needs of all of our children. So, you know, we already know what works.
Right.
You know, there's certain sort of fundamental things that are well established, solidly established by the research. There are things like quality early childhood education and small class sizes, especially in the early grades, and well-trained, supported teachers, again, who have the autonomy to use the knowledge they have to meet the needs of the children.
So
and what I'm concerned about is that if we, you know, if this ballot question succeeds, and I'm curious to hear what Chris thinks about the ballot question, that we will be losing, you know, just the resources for district schools will just be decimated and a lot of really basic needs of children will not be met.
Okay, so two parts there, and then let's just hit the first part that you brought up. I mean, Chris, what do you think of the idea that perhaps talking about a third way now is, as Lisa put it, a distraction from this very concrete question about lifting the charter cap that voters will have to vote on in November?
I think that's the distraction. I mean, I think we've got tens of thousands, really hundreds of thousands of students in Massachusetts doing poorly in our most struggling communities. And I don't think that the charter cap is the central issue. I think we have to come up with ways that move beyond where we've been stuck. So, you know, when Lisa, we say, you know, it's unproven, I take a look at, say, Lawrence, where that was the lowest performing and corrupt district in the state. Student performance has, you know, vaulted up. The mayor, when he asked for the receivership, and I'm not, the third way is not about receiverships, although the educational strategy they took forward in Lawrence is very much the same one that we are doing in Springfield once, you know, once you say how to actually improve the schools. But, you know, the mayor wrote a letter saying, my kids are thriving in some schools, including some charters, I might add. My kids are thriving in those schools and doing poorly in my own schools. It's got to be somewhat about how the schools are being run. And lo and behold, 3 years later, the schools are doing a lot better. In Denver, where they've gone to a version of this third way strategy that does involve the district and the charters working more collaboratively, they've gone from the lowest growth urban district in Colorado to the highest growth urban district in Colorado. So they've gained population, unlike a place like Boston where the schools have been losing population. Denver public schools have been gaining population from suburbs and other schools. So I think there's actually a fair amount of evidence that when you get away from the fight about governance and the fight, the political fight some people want to have, and focus on how to get educators the opportunity they need and deserve to drive success for kids, that good decisions get made, and the outcome's better. And I think we need to get about doing that.
Okay, so what about the second point that Lisa made, that that there isn't necessarily any need for, quote-unquote, third-way innovation when it comes to education, that she had a list of all these best practices that we already know have very positive outcomes for children, early childhood education, greater support for teachers, smaller classroom sizes, all these things. You know, why... You know, why look to a third way when we could just be doing these things more?
Well, I think it comes down to, you know, results and where we stand. I mean, Massachusetts has one of the largest achievement gaps in the country. We have, and in a place like Springfield, you know, many of these schools are in the first or second percentile of the state for middle schools. These are schools that are really struggling. The students are very challenged. There's a lot of disadvantage. There are certainly people who focus on saying, what more can we do for housing? What more can we do for jobs for the families? But I also think there's what more can we do in those schools. Let me take a simple example. Run the hours kids need. Almost all successful charter schools and all the schools in Springfield that are in the zone, all the schools in Lawrence that are K-8, now run the hours kids need, which is a longer school day. And they do it and pay teachers more. But do it in an affordable way.
Lisa, I'm going to get you back in here. But Chris, I just have to ask you a question. I mean, what is your response to anyone who hears you and says, this third way to me just sounds like a Trojan horse for charter schools?
Sure. I mean, I closed my comments by saying some people are going to say this is a defense for the inertia of districts, and some people are going to say this is exactly Trojan horse for charters. And to them, I say, look, you guys are going to spend probably $25, $30 million fighting on TV. You're commanding almost all of the attention of all the media with the fight between charters and districts. We're busy just trying to help some kids in schools get ahead. So, you know, the third way is happening. There are 400 people at that event, the Secretary of Education of our state, the United States Secretary of Education. I think it's kind of hard to deny that something good is happening on the ground when people get away from the political fights.
Lisa Geisbond, your response to that?
Well, the ballot question is also happening, and it's a big threat. And I do wonder if you support the ballot question or not, Chris, because I just think what happens with that is going to really lay the groundwork for, you know, a devastating effect on our schools. And I'll just give the example of Boston schools, where we've seen, I believe WBUR has reported very well on students walking out, thousands of students walking out of school because they've seen the resources flow out of their school. They've seen staff cut, excellent programming cut, like the diploma Plus program in Charlestown. I mean, this is not an abstract theoretical conversation for these kids. They see it happening right before their eyes, and they see the potential for more resources to flow out of their schools and more cuts to their education and their younger brothers and sisters' education. So, you know, this is not abstract. Yeah. This is concrete.
So I want to take a couple callers here in just a second, but since you've asked twice, Chris Gabrielle, let me just put the question to you as well. Are you in support of the ballot measure to lift the cap on charters in November?
Let me answer that two ways. As a flag carrier for this third way, I'm trying to step away from the fight. So, you know, I have friends on both sides. In Lawrence and Springfield, for example, all of the work we're doing and involved in is in district schools with neighborhood assignments. You know, it's about raising the performance of those. It's done in partnership with them. It's done in partnership with the unions. So I feel comfortable that. It's also done in partnership in some cases with some people who used to work in charters and with some entities that have operated charters. And when they're willing to work in a district setting, take the students assigned in the neighborhood, take a union contract and bring their A game, I think they're a great ally. So my big answer is I don't think it's, you know, I think that is where all the resources are being wasted right now. How I will personally vote in the ballot, I mean, I run for office in support of charters. I mean, of course, it's pretty clear. I haven't changed my view. I don't think, though, that's the solution. That's not where I'm putting my time and energy. I'm putting my time and energy into working with people to build constructive solutions that are making a difference for large numbers of kids now by dropping the fight. So, you know, I don't want to get tempted into sort of debating, you know, something that we can debate till the cows come home. But for most kids in the state, it's going to make no difference either which way.
All right, let's take that's a yes.
Well, let's take some callers here. Paul is calling from Lunenburg. You're on the air, Paul.
All right, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. I really felt I needed to call in. I've been a public school teacher for 20 years, and I want to say that my opposition to charters is really based on the idea that I see them as siphoning off money and kids, and it's people chasing a simplified solution to a very complex problem. And I think I like the idea of this third way. Lisa talked about all the best practices that we know of. Chris talked about the fact that district schools are often tied because monies are allocated and decisions are based on how much money is available. And yeah, families want what's best for their kids, but so do teachers. And if we look for a simple solution, let's just up the charters.
Paul, let me just jump in here because, Paul, if I could just jump in here, the reason why we're having this conversation is because there are people, including Chris Gabrielli, who are saying we shouldn't just be looking for a simple solution, that we should try to move the conversation beyond district versus charter schools. I mean, so let me just ask you, from your perspective as a public school teacher, do you think it's even possible for us to see to have a conversation about a third way, about incorporating best practices into some new model for education?
Well, as Mr. Gabrielli was saying, that if we can wrest control away from the folks who control the money and allow schools to make choices that work for their students, that's how we move forward. But when we get into the political campaign of an us versus them, we're not serving our kids either way.
Paul, I'm going to take it back from you because I want to get to some other calls, but it's a great point, and thank you so much for calling. Lisa Geisbaum, let me just turn that to you before I get to another caller. I mean, Paul, in a way, was saying that there's part of what Chris Gabrielli is saying that he thinks seems reasonable.
I think part of what Chris Gabrielli is saying seems reasonable, too, but I just feel like we can't really go there when we're facing this sort of Damocles over our heads that I just think is going to be so destructive. Like, if we defeat the ballot question, maybe we can go on and talk about third ways, although I still think that we know what works and we need to have the resources and invest them broadly so that every child has these opportunities to have, you know, a whole child education and not be chasing after, you know, test scores in math and reading.
Right. Chris?
I mean, one of your producers on the interview me for this said, you sound like you're too optimistic. And I said, when I hear of someone like Paul, an educator concerned about charters, but also wanting the autonomy at his school to be part of making the decision. I have seen so many educators in buildings in Springfield and Lawrence and in Denver and other places who, for the first time, get to make choices about the curriculum at the school. For the first time, set a schedule they think will work for kids. For the first time, are allowed to be on a hiring committee that decides who to hire for the school when there are new openings. if we don't bet on the educators who are directly facing the kids, and if we don't tap into the reason they went into teaching and give them all the tools and opportunities, including the kinds of practices Lisa's talking about, I don't know who we think is going to get it done. Command and control by any force, benign, malignant, in between. We've been trying that for a long time, and we've not been able to command our way to success. We got to trust our educators to be able to take advantage of these tools and go for it. Hold them accountable eventually, but give them the shot.
Well, let's take one more call here in the last couple seconds that we have. Tim is calling from Springfield. You're on the air, Tim.
Good afternoon. Two things. Number one, DESE needs to come up with an accountability system that is no longer about shame, blame, and punish, but is about study, learn, and support. And speaking of support, the legislature studied the funding of public education for a year, and they came to the conclusion that it wasn't adequate and it wasn't equitable. The equitable part is where we have the most failing schools in our gateway cities. And I certainly hope that our legislature finds the courage to do what I think they're morally obligated to do and support our schools with the most needy children so that we have the resources so we can meet the needs of these challenged children and they can be successful.
Tim, thank you so much for your call. And I want to get a last thought on what Tim said from both Lisa and Chris before we wrap up here. So Lisa, go ahead.
I completely agree with everything Tim just said, and we need to find the resources. We don't have the resources right now, and that's why I support the millionaire's tax, which would really help us get the resources that we need to give every child in Massachusetts the opportunities they need.
Chris Gabrielli?
Totally agree. Tim is right. Springfield's being shortchanged to the tune of $24 million a year because the foundation budget is not actually meeting the original definition of what it was supposed to be. For many suburban communities and for Boston that are well above foundation, it's less of an issue. In places like Lawrence and Springfield, where they're right at the foundation, we are, I think, violating our constitutional obligation, and that those resources would matter.
Well, Chris Gabrielli is CEO of the education consulting firm Empower Schools. He's also chairman of the Massachusetts Board of Higher Education. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Lisa Geisbahn, executive director of Citizens for Public Schools, which has been supporting public schools in Massachusetts since 1982. Lisa, thank you as well.
Thank you.
We'll be back in a minute. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Massachusetts is a state of many firsts. The same is true about this state and slavery. Massachusetts was the first state to abolish slavery in 1783, but it was also the first state to legalize it 140 years earlier in 1641. And even before that, in 1621, when the Pilgrims were suffering through their first long winter at Plymouth, how was it possible that a member of the Pawtuxet tribe approached the starving colonists and offered his help, and he did so in English? Well, Squanto, or Tisquantum, had been enslaved by an Englishman in 1614 and then escaped bondage 3 years later. All of which is to say, slavery is as old as New England, though it's perhaps not talked about enough. And as Wendy Warren writes in her new book, the two violent enterprises of slavery and colonization were interlocking gears driving American history from the beginning. Warren is a professor of history at Princeton, and her new book is entitled New England Bound, Slavery and Colonization in Early America, and she joins us now. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you. What an eye-opening book. I'm wondering if you could just start with what you describe slavery in New England looked like early on. Because frequently, I mean, we've talked a lot on this show about the slave trade, but I think comparatively less is talked about like people who were actually enslaved in the early New England colonies. Why were they, and what did their lives look like?
Well, their lives, the labor they did looked a lot like the labor of freedom. So what's distinctive about 17th century New England, I suppose, is that it's a period of settler colonization. Everything is still being settled, and there's no racialized labor regime. That is to say, the slaves do what colonists do. They work alongside them. In fact, recovering the labor of slavery in New England can be a little tricky because the labor can seem invisible because they're not doing different labor. Enslaved people hauled water, they cut trees, they worked in warehouses, they cooked dinners, they watered horses, they built houses, they hunted, they did the labor that needed to be done in a precarious colonial situation. What they didn't do is grow cash crops, for example. They didn't do the kinds of things that we more often associate with slave labor. It simply wasn't settled enough to do that. And in New England, they did distinctively New England things, all the things I just mentioned. Mm. So when we talk about this Atlantic system, which historians talk about a lot, this huge network of trade that envelops the whole Atlantic Ocean, it's important to remember that the people who are caught up in the heart of that system, who find themselves violently uprooted on one coast of the Atlantic and end up eventually, some of them in New England, do settle down in one place and do distinctive labor. Some of them surely end up on sugar plantations, yeah. A lot of them. But some of them end up in New England doing distinctively New England work.
Right. And in fact, I mean, they were so, these enslaved people were so, I don't want to say commonplace, but so much a fact of life in early New England colonial history that they even appear in moments and in events that are famous for other reasons. And I have to shamefully say, I had no idea. For example, you tell the story of an enslaved man named Juan who actually testified in the Salem witchcraft trials in 1679. Can you tell us about him?
Well, he doesn't testify in those trials, but he is in Salem earlier. It's an unusual, it's a very typical New England slave story, I suppose. He's out getting firewood one day in Salem, and his horses bolt into a swamp, and it's with great difficulty, and if I recall correctly, with the help of bystanders, that he's able to get them back into their harness and doing what they should be doing. And neighboring colonists who have seen this, witnesses, and he all agree they've never seen horses behave like that, and they eventually all come to the conclusion that the horses have been bewitched. And they decide that a certain neighbor has done this. What is distinctive about this, what is peculiar, I suppose, or interesting, is that this man, his name Juan suggests, tells us that he's not from the region, right, as almost no slaves, African slaves, were in 17th century. So he's been caught up in this violent system. And what does he end up? What is the end result of this system? He hauls firewood in Salem. And what do we find him doing? Something so distinctively New England. He's caught up in a witch scare. Mm. Eventually, he thinks he sees witches, and he testifies to that effect well before the trials, but right. Also in Salem. So it's this familiar Salem of witches, but it's a different Salem. It's a port town that faces the Atlantic in which enslaved people work, as in fact Salem was. It was a busy port town.
I mean, it's this brutal irony that you talk about, that in fact the work that the enslaved people were doing was so commonplace and so very New England that that's exactly the thing that rendered them invisible to history. But you also write that, for example, if I have this right, the first codification of slavery in the United States was written in New England, the Body of Liberties, in 1641. What was that?
That's right. That was just a code of law. I mean, 1641, Massachusetts Bay Colony, still very early in its existence, and they need to write up a code of law. So some colonists are assigned this task and do so, and one of the things they do is codify slavery. They say that there won't be any slaves unless they're caught in just wars. And for, a couple other caveats. But, of course, just wars are it's a very capacious category. And enslaved people are captured across the ocean, very often in wars. And by the time a colonist in New England or anywhere else buys them, their point of capture is long lost to history. So, in fact, it turns out to be a very capacious law. It allows slavery pretty readily.
So tell us more about, all these examples that you give are leading me to ask, you know, you write very eloquently in the beginning of the book how, that language that I use is yours, about how the intermeshing gears of slavery and colonization were the two things that were really driving American history beginning in the 17th century. Tell us more about why they were so critical to each other.
Why is New England so successful? It's not just for, my students, when they enter my classes, believe very strongly in the myth of the sort of hardworking Puritan. But the New England colonies are part of an Atlantic system, and what's driving that system, what's in some ways funding New England, what's fueling the whole process is eventually sugar slavery in the Caribbean. And New England's caught up in that pretty aggressively. New England colonies are, Massachusetts Bay is closely tied to a place like Jamaica and Barbados. You know, by the 1670s, half the ships in Boston's harbor are coming directly to or directly from Barbados. or the West Indies in general. This is a huge connection. And so the New England, the success story of New England, I put success in scare quotes, if you will, but the successful colonization of New England is in large part derived from the power of these sugar plantations. So what we see is, what we tend to see as distinctive entities, you know, the sort of unslaved New England colonies versus the slaved West Indian plantations, they're linked in ways that we haven't really acknowledged.
Yeah.
And early.
And were there early on sort of contemporary misgivings about slavery? Because, you know, I started echoing the story of Squantum that you write about in the book. And, you know, even people at that time had said that what had happened to him was wrong. But, of course, slavery remained legal in places like Massachusetts for, you know, more than a century or more or two thereafter.
Right. So I would say that the enslaved people immediately feel misgivings about the about the institution of slavery. But if we're talking about colonists, misgivings are voiced at various points for various reasons, but never never systemic critiques, not until very late in the century, if even then at all. So you get occasional colonists sort of showing discomfort at perhaps how an individual or a couple of individuals were captured. But what you don't get is the systemic critique that will come later in the 18th century.
Mm. But you write about something called the Rainbow Affair.
So there is a case, it's, I think, oft cited as an example of New England's ambivalence towards slavery, in which some slaves end up in Massachusetts and they've been taken from Africa in a New England ship has sort of, I mean, the records are very laconic on this issue, but somehow the New England ship has gotten involved in an African slave raiding trip. And they, these slaves eventually end up back in Massachusetts where their authorities come to learn that not only were they taken perhaps in an unjust war or an unjust raid, but moreover, they're taken on the Sabbath. Hmm. And this is a sort of extra extra crime on top of the possible crime of the unjust war or raid. And it seems to be actually, if you look at the records, the Sabbath breaking is what troubles authorities most of all. So in this particular incident, the slaves are actually ordered back to Africa, returned to Africa. We don't know if that happened. There's no record that that did happen. And it's hard to imagine how you return a slave to West Africa. But it is this one moment where people do voice some discomfort. It's used, I think, it's been cited too often as example of some sort of inherent Puritan discomfort with slavery, which there wasn't really any such inherent Puritan discomfort with slavery. What it is discomfort with is breaking the Sabbath, which is more typical of maybe New England authorities' concerns.
Right. Well, I mean, in a way, to underscore that point, it wasn't until, as we talked about earlier, 1783, I believe, that slavery is abolished in Massachusetts.
Right. It happens quite late. And even then, it's a sort of gradual emancipation. So you have slaves well into the 19th century. You know, you're emancipated when you turn 30. But that can be, that's a lot of your adult life.
Yeah. And then also in the book, you write about how quickly this history, you know, has been forgotten. I mean, I'm not talking, you know, 20 or 21st century forgetfulness, but 19th century forgetfulness, because you write about how Nathaniel Hawthorne wrote in 1838 about his surprise seeing African Americans at Williams College.
Right. So, you know, in the 19th century, the Civil War plays a big role in how people understand and narrate by then the American states, the United States. And I think the North-South dichotomy becomes pretty entrenched. And people really start to think plantation slavery the moment the cotton plantation really is what slavery is. When people think of slavery, they think of the cotton plantation. So the early history and how it was actually scattered through all the colonies is a little lost by the end of the Civil War. And certainly now, you know, in the 20th century, historians who are interested in slavery would not instinctively have gone to New England. There never really were that many slaves there. If you really wanted to work with slavery and understand plantation slavery and wanted voluminous records, you would have headed to the South. And I think that sort of perpetuated this false dichotomy.
Right. But in the last minute, few seconds actually that we have, as you say, in order to truly understand New England's success in the colonial era, we cannot divorce it from the slave history or the slavery history here.
Right. I think there's some use in understanding that people on a noble mission could really make some big misjudgments. I think there's some use in learning that lesson of humility.
Well, Wendy Warren is a professor of history at Princeton University and author of the new book, New England Bound, Slavery and Colonization in Early America. Fascinating book and a real pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
We've got more information about Wendy's book at our website, radioboston.org. That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.